Welcome to Oncology Today, current and future management of HER2-altered non-small cell lung cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. John Heymach from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and to begin, he provided an overview of the various HER2 alterations observed in non-small cell lung cancer.
There's really two different types of alterations, if we're just going to group them into two buckets, and each of those has two sort of sub-buckets. If we start with the HER2 overexpression, this is what we're used to in other tumor types, breast cancer, for example. And so, you know, I'm sure anybody listening has more experience than I do treating breast cancer, but there we think of HER2 overexpression you might see by immunohistochemistry, IHC. That's just saying that there's a lot of the protein. And then HER2 amplified, where the gene itself is copied. Now, HER2 amplified is what you might get back from an NGS report from DNA sequencing, right? Whereas the HER2 protein overexpression, you would need to send a test. You would need to send an IHC test. So in lung cancer, we have those two types, IHC positive and amplified. And then we've got HER2 mutant, which is a whole separate bucket, if you will. Now, tumors are different in terms of how much of each of these they have. Breast cancer is mainly overexpressed and amplified, and they've got a small number, less than 1% of mutant. Lung cancer is mainly mutant, and they do occasionally have HER2 amplified or HER2 overexpressed. Now, all the recent progress has been in this HER2 mutant category. And so right now for HER2 mutant, and that's about 3 or 4% of lung cancer. So it's about as common as ALK fusions, for example, right? For HER2 mutant, there you can divide it into TKD mutations, tyrosine kinase domain mutations. And that's where it's between exon 18 and 21. Most of those are the YVMA, you know, that's a common one. Now, for those tyrosine kinase domain mutations, right now zongertinib is approved. That's just the oral medication you take. That's a standard TKI, like the way we treat EGFR mutant. This is an equivalent for HER2 mutant, where we're taking a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. There's also non-TKD mutations. Now, zongertinib has activity there, but it's not yet approved for it. The FDA label for zongertinib specifically says TKD mutations. For the other mutants out there, and this is where you get into the extracellular mutants and the transmembrane mutants, TDXD is approved. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is approved for the non-TKD mutants. All right. So you know, to go back and summarize that, the overexpressed can either be positive by immunohistochemistry or amplification. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is approved for the overexpressed. It has a pan-tumor label for the 3+ by immunohistochemistry across all the different tumor types. So that includes lung, and that does happen occasionally. Okay, so if you came back, if you sent off immunohistochemistry, it said 3+. Even if it doesn't have a mutation, you could use trastuzumab deruxtecan. But if it comes back and says you have a mutation, the mutation is probably going to be an exon 20 insertion. It might be something like this YVMA. The vast majority of HER2 mutants in lung are these tyrosine kinase domain mutations, like exon 20 insertions. And that's what zongertinib is approved for there.
So in terms of TDXD, is it approved in all types of mutations, or the TKD or non-TKD?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So trastuzumab deruxtecan's label right now includes TKD and non-TKD, and then it has a separate indication that's across all tumor types for 3+. So if your report came back and you did IHC and it was 3+, you could give trastuzumab deruxtecan. If it came back and said there was a mutation, most of those, the vast majority, are tyrosine kinase domain, and then zongertinib's approved. A small percentage of those are not tyrosine kinase domain, and right now the FDA label would be to use trastuzumab deruxtecan for those.
And does TDXD, though, work on both? Does it work with TKD mutations also?
Okay. Yeah. So the cohort that I presented, the Destiny Lung 2, the response rate was 49%, and that was largely TKD mutations. They have a little bit of data in non-TKD. So you could use trastuzumab deruxtecan for any of those, but for the TKD, you see the pill, zongertinib, is approved and, has a higher response rate, longer PFS, easier to tolerate.
So let me say also that as soon as you started talking about TKD mutations, my mind immediately flipped to AML, where I've worked with, I mean, you guys there at MD Anderson have the most elite AML group in the world. And obviously there, FLT3, TKD and non-TKD, there's a quizartinib's approved only with a TKD. Is it that kind of the same type of analogy in terms of the type of mutations?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So when you have mutations in the tyrosine kinase domain, it sort of turn it keeps that the tyrosine kinase turned on constitutively, and you're just directly blocking that tyrosine kinase domain with the TKI, with the pill. Whereas trastuzumab deruxtecan is an antibody, so it binds on the outside of the cell, and it doesn't really matter what's happening in the inside the cell in the kinase domain, because trastuzumab deruxtecan binds to the outside of the cell, so it's active against essentially all these different HER2 alterations.
So as I was watching you present, I was having the thought of, is zongertinib the new gefitinib? Is HER2, mutant, or specifically HER2 TKD mutations, would you consider that a driver mutation?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the answer for HER2 mutants is yes. For amplified, it's no. And let me explain that a little bit more. What we usually think of as a driver in lung cancer is, first of all, the tumor's really addicted to it. So if you block it, tumors usually shrink. Secondly, they don't usually occur with other drivers when you start off. So for example, HER2 mutants would not co-occur with EGFR or KRAS or other mutants. So in that respect, HER2 behaves just like the other drivers in non-small cell lung cancer, behaves just like EGFR, KRAS, RET fusions, ALK fusions, and so forth. It's usually in non-smokers. It's usually mutually exclusive. HER2 amplification, on the other hand, that's really not a driver. It occurs with all sorts of other mutations. It occurs, just in a wide distribution of tumors, but it doesn't have the properties of a driver, where if you inhibit it, the tumors are highly likely to shrink. So that's why at this point, if you had a HER2 overexpressing tumor, that's where T-DXd is the choice, trastuzumab deruxtecan, and not the TKI. But for the addicted tumors right now, the TKI looks like it has more favorable tolerability and higher activity.
So I want to get into your cases in a second and learn a little bit more about these TKIs because it seems like a new ball game. This is not what I heard in breast cancer. For, neratinib has been looked at with HER2 mutant T-DXd and breast cancer also. This sounds like something very different. Do you see these HER2 TKD mutations outside of lung cancer? Do you see it in breast? Do you see it in other tumors, for example?
Yeah, you do. In fact, they're expressed in more than 20 different tumor types. So they're really widely expressed. But the issue is that they're a very low percentage in each of those. They're typically less than 1 or 2% in most tumor types. So that's why these drugs are really studied first in non-small cell, because it's about 3 or 4% in non-small cell, but non-small cell occurs with such a high frequency that it ends up being the biggest population of HER2 mutants is non-small cell lung cancer.
But I mean, could you envision a day where maybe there's going to be a pan-tumor approval for some of these TKIs with HER2, and just like if you see RET in another tumor, there's a pan-tumor BRAF, et cetera. Is that the direction you see things going here?
Yeah, it absolutely is. So there's now basket studies of saying, okay, now zongertinib is approved for non-small cell. Now there's studies in every other tumor type that's got HER2 mutants. So because of the frequency, they're putting them all together into a basket application, like TRK fusions, for example, for the approval for larotrectinib across different tumor types. Exactly the same situation.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm always looking for macro explanations there, and that really helped me a lot. So let's sort of dig more into the details, particularly about these new agents. I mean, again, I was looking at the waterfall plots, the response rates, the duration, everything reminded me of, you know, EGFR, RET, ALK, et cetera. So I guess really what you're saying is now we've got a new driver mutation in this world, so to speak.
Yeah. That's exactly what we're saying. And, you know, it tells you now for non-small cell, you know, that number is about 10 now, 10 different driver oncogenes that you really right. need to check for before you treat your patients. In the last year, we've had NRG1 fusions added to the mix, which are related to these with the, you know, with the recent approval we had. You know, we've had MET exon 14s that are also on this list of drivers. Of course, you've got BRAF. RET fusions, NTRK fusions, ALK fusions, and then the old standbys, EGFR, you know, KRAS, BRAF, and so forth. So it's really a big, healthy, growing list. And it also highlights it's becoming more and more challenging to run assays that cover all of those. So it really tells you that you know, having these big NGS panels is really critical if you have any hope of catching them all.
And right now, when you get a typical NGS report, does it stipulate this is a TKD mutation? It may be sensitive to these new TKIs. You know, I know in the past you just saw there was a mutation. They didn't really say much about it.
Yeah. You know, I think we're still waiting to see, you know, all the reports, you know, coming through. I think most of the major providers we'll tell you it's a tyrosine kinase domain mutation. We'll tell you that, you know, or not a tyrosine kinase domain mutation. But there is a lot of subtlety here. And this is something we're working to figure out because even within the mutations that aren't in the kinase domain, there are different flavors, transmembrane versus extracellular, that respond differently to therapies. And, you know, like EGFR, you know, EGFR, we started off with just saying activating mutations. But we later developed more subtlety around exon 20 insertions, you know, and other atypicals like PAC mutants and so forth. Well, here, you know, over time, I expect we'll develop more subtlety about the specific type of HER2 mutation. But right now, the most common types are exon 20 insertions. So that's really what we're targeting. When we say HER2 mutations, the majority are these you know, these YVMA insertions in exon 20.
And again, that's different than an EGFR exon 20 insertion?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So they're structurally pretty similar, but an EGFR exon 20 is a minority, right? It's only the exon 20 insertions in EGFR mutant are less than 10% or about 10%. In HER2, you know, they're about 80% of the mutations. So for some reason in HER2, it's much more prone to exon 20 insertions than EGFR is.
So another issue that has been out there for a while, and I've always been wondering in general how HER2 fits into the immunotherapy paradigm. Because, you know, when you think about EGFR, RET, and ALK, you think non-smoker, they're not going to respond in IO. Looks like these TKD also, are they mainly non-smokers? And again, do they respond to IOs?
Yeah, great question. You know, like other drivers, or most other drivers, HER2 mutations occur primarily in non-smokers. They're more likely to be females than males. You know, we see high rates in Asian countries like EGFR, and these do not respond well to immunotherapy. In fact, there have been a couple of analyses. One was called the OncoTarget, led by Julian Mazares, and then there was another one by Marcelo Negrao in our group that was published in the last couple of years. And there it showed if you've got a HER2 mutation, you did not respond well to immunotherapy by itself. The median progression-free survival was on the order of 3 months or so. So really, this is a group where immunotherapy is not a great option for the vast majority of people. You want to target HER2, you know, either with the TKI or an ADC like trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Also, I was thinking about these first-line trials with these TKIs that are out there, kind of reminding me of the old IPASS study. Probably a lot of people who are new to oncology don't even remember that.
Yeah, but, that's right.
Early on, I think it was even in the gefitinib days, there was a study comparing, I think it was gefitinib to chemotherapy.
Yeah.
Everybody was wondering what it was going to show. So that showed it was better. Then we didn't really see too much outside of EGFR. People started to just say, well, you know, if it's a driver mutation, you have an effective TKI with a response rate over 60%, it's probably going to work. We didn't always get great, you know, phase three trials. But it kind of looks like that's what we ought to be expecting, that they're probably going to be better than chemo. Is that your take?
Yeah, that's what I would guess. I think you highlight the right study. So the IPASS study was back in, I believe it was published in 2007. Tony Mock was the first author of that.
Right.
And that was a study of gefitinib versus standard chemo at the time, you know, carboplatin and paclitaxel mainly. And, you know, I think you summarized it correctly. If you had an EGFR mutation, you had a huge benefit from gefitinib. If you didn't have a mutation, then you got no benefit from gefitinib and chemo was better. And that was really the study that told everybody you need to be selecting your patients based on the mutation. You know, we've had multiple studies since then where the targeted therapy always, virtually always beats chemotherapy. You know, in EGFR mutant, we later had the FLAURA study of osimertinib
right.
versus chemo that was strongly positive. You know, we had a study of alectinib versus chemo or crizotinib originally versus chemotherapy that was strongly positive for the TKI. We had one recently with selpercatinib versus chemo for RET fusions that was stronger. So in all these studies, you know, chemo gives you a median PFS typically in the mid single digits, you know, something like, you know, 5 to 7 or 8 months, depending on the fusion. And the targeted agent is typically much, much longer than that.
Although, you know, now, 18 years later, we have chemo plus now osimertinib
right.
as an alternative. Do you think that at some point we might have chemo plus TKI?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you take a drug like zongertinib, it's really easily tolerated like osimertinib is. And, you know, I think as we look for approaches to intensification, you know, that's a logical one to consider for intensification. So I think that's something that would make a lot of sense is testing, you know, like the FLAURA2 regimen of taking osimertinib and adding chemo,
right.
taking
right.
the BEAMIE and Lung 1 regimen and adding chemotherapy to that.
So one more question until we dive into these specific TKIs. I was fascinated to see a paper you had in Cancer looking at the impact of select actionable genomic alterations on efficacy of neoadjuvant immunotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer, you know, further getting into this issue, you know, because in the past we, you know, we've had some data on this question of IOs with targetable mutation, but not anything like this where you actually look at the treatment. What did you see there?
Yeah, well, so really interesting. If you take you know, neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And right now we have three approved regimens. So one is chemotherapy with pembrolizumab, then surgery, then pembro afterwards. We call that the KEYNOTE-671 regimen. We have chemotherapy with Nevo, followed by surgery and Nevo afterwards. That's the CheckMate 77T. And chemotherapy with durvalumab, followed by surgery and durvalumab afterwards. That's the AEGEAN. So those are our three perioperative studies. And, you know, we also know for driver oncogenes, we have adjuvant therapy for EGFR. That's osimertinib if you have an EGFR mutation. And for ALK fusions, that's alectinib. That's the ALENA regimen. But what about all the other drivers, you know, that we don't have approved regimens for? Do you still get benefit with the immunotherapy? So, you know, for example, if you've got a NTRK fusion or if you've got HER2 mutant or, you know, you can go down the list, you know, and the answer is not a big surprise. If you've got a driver mutation, you don't get as much benefit from neoadjuvant chemotherapy and immunotherapy as the group that doesn't have the driver mutation. I mean, I think that's consistent with the fact that we know, you know, typically the greatest benefit we see from immunotherapy are those that have a smoking history, those that have a high tumor mutation burden. But usually our driver oncogenes don't get a lot of benefit from immunotherapy. I'll mention one exception. One exception is BRAF. BRAF mutants do tend to respond well to immunotherapy, like in melanoma, where they respond beautifully.
So in like in the neoadjuvant setting, you see them benefit from chemo plus an IO with BRAF, but not the other, not EGFR and everything else.
The others, not, yeah, not, they don't get the same relative advantage to adding immunotherapy that others do. Now, I'd say for KRAS, there's also subgroups of KRAS that benefit from immunotherapy well, especially the KRAS that have P53 mutations in them.
So with that as sort of an introduction and kind of a long introduction, but this is not the simplest story for people to digest. I personally, it's been very informative to me, but let's move to the next point, which is particularly these new TKIs. Can you just sort of summarize what we know about zongertinib and also sevabertinib, what we know about their mechanisms, how they're structured, and the clinical activity at this point, and where you see them heading?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, when it came to EGFR, and, you know, HER2 and EGFR are closely related, you know, there we went through different generations, and we started with non-covalent inhibitors. Gefitinib and erlotinib are the first generation. They are not covalently in drugs. And then we later developed the covalent inhibitors like osimertinib. Osimertinib covalently links to EGFR. Well, here we've done it in the reverse order. So the first drug that's approved is zongertinib. Zongertinib is similar to osimertinib. That's a covalent drug, meaning it fits into the binding pocket, and then it forms a little cysteine bridge with the binding pocket of HER2. There's a particular residue called the cysteine 805, C805. It's sort of the equivalent for the EGFR aficionados. This is the equivalent of the C797 in EGFR. It's in the same structural location. It's right near the mouth of the pocket. And, you know, it forms that covalent link, and it's in there. It's that means that receptor is gone for good because it's an irreversible inhibitor. Now, that has advantages, but it also has some disadvantages, you know, as well. Now, sevabertinib is a reversible inhibitor, so it doesn't depend on the covalent bridge. Now, what's the advantage of a covalent versus a non-covalent or otherwise said as an irreversible versus a reversible inhibitor? Well, the covalent ones all depend on that one amino acid in HER2, that 805 residue. And if that mutates, you can get resistance to it. Whereas with sevabertinib, it doesn't require a covalent linkage, so it doesn't develop resistance by that same mechanism. Now, how frequently does that resistance happen through the 805? Well, I think that's, you know, to be reported in the future. We really don't have a lot of data yet about resistance to zongertinib, but that's at least one theoretical advantage of a reversible compared to an irreversible. On the other hand, we think irreversible inhibitors do a better job of shutting down the signaling because once it's in there for good. It doesn't fall off. So pluses and minuses in terms of the mechanism. I think the other key clinical characteristic that's different is zongertinib really inhibits HER2 and doesn't inhibit EGFR to any significant extent. Sevabertinib inhibits EGFR, and that may have certain advantages if your tumor depends on EGFR, but the disadvantage is that it causes diarrhea and rash. Remember, diarrhea and rash are leading to EGFR-related toxicities. So sevabertinib's got a lot more diarrhea in particular. Zongertinib, virtually no grade 3 diarrhea at all. So a little better tolerated zongertinib is than sevabertinib.
It kind of looked to me like the efficacy seems similar. I mean, the untreated response rate seems pretty similar, the two drugs. Is that your take? And is it mainly a difference in toxicity?
Yeah, I think when we look in the second line setting, the response rates are pretty similar, about 71% for zongertinib. For sevabertinib, it's 63%. Or 64, but the progression-free survival is a little bit different. PFS for zongertinib was 12.4 months. For sevabertinib, it was 8.3 months. And if you look at the tolerability and how frequently people needed dose reductions, there's a lot more active management of the diarrhea that needed to be done with sevabertinib that really wasn't an issue with zongertinib. So I think in the second line setting, we're seeing longer PFS and a little better tolerability profile for zongertinib, but sevabertinib is still clearly active, you know, and I think lesson we've learned from other spaces is you like to have choices. You want to have drugs that work differently because, you know, they will turn out to be different situations where one or the other drug is likely to be better.
Yeah, and actually, you know, when we think about it, you had gefitinib, you had erlotinib, a lot of use of erlotinib.
Yep.
And we heard a lot about quality of life issues there. Then when osimertinib came along, we stopped hearing about that so much. Is it kind of similar in quality of life differences, you know, with sevabertinib compared to zongertinib?
I think that certainly the biggest differences relate to these EGFR toxicity. In those clinical trials, if you look at the subsequent cohorts, the rates of diarrhea, you know, of grade 3 diarrhea went down. And I think, you know, like any group, you know, the investigators there got more accustomed to how to manage the diarrhea more effectively, putting in protocols in place of how to do it in an optimal way. So, you know, certainly sevabertinib is manageable, you know, when you've got investigators familiar with managing the diarrhea. I think with zongertinib, it really didn't require any management on that side. You know, I think the rates of needing additional medications were pretty low.
So again, one other question before we get into your cases, I have to ask you this. You're so great at explaining mechanisms in a way, at least that I can understand it. You know, thinking about what you were talking about, covalent versus non-covalent, thinking about Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors, you have covalent TKIs that were, you know, ibrutinib, calibrutinib, zanubrutinib, and now you have a non-covalent pirtobrutinib coming along, maybe even going to be competing with that. Is it a kind of similar story to what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, you know, a key question is how do tumors become resistant to these drugs?
Right.
To the extent, you know, the way at least I think about these covalent inhibitors is they're better at shutting everything down, but they're more vulnerable to a single mutation causing resistance. That one spot where it covalently links, if that changes, the drug's got nothing. You know, so it's sort of all or none, you know, based on that one, you know, the one amino acid, the cysteine that it links to. Whereas the reversible inhibitors, whether or not you mutated that key cysteine, the 805, they still can combine very well. On the other hand, they may not get as complete shutdown because they bind in and out, and you don't know how much of the time that the receptor is able to, you know, signal there as well. So, you know, it's a little different profile now. You know, I think what will develop in the field, you know, and the same happened with EGFR, you know, it took a while for us to understand how do tumors become resistant to erlotinib, you know, and gefitinib. That was, a lot of that was that T790M mutation.
Right,
versus
right.
Osimertinib. Well, for osimertinib, you had that C797S where in covalent links, but you also had things like MET amplification, all these things that were independent of EGFR. Well, if we take the same analogy here for HER2, you know, and we have to wait and see what the data shows, but one imagines you might end up seeing a number of different mutations for the sevabertinib, and for the zongertinib, you might see either those 805 mutations or other things getting turned on like MET amplification, you know, what we call these bypass pathways where other things get turned on. So, you know, we've got a lot to learn, but all this becomes really relevant now that we have different choices. If we didn't have any choices, you know, this would be an academic discussion. You know, right now, docs have two choices, and perhaps in the future, they'll have three choices of different drugs to use for these patients.
All right. Well, let's get into your cases. We'll get a little more granular about how this plays out in clinical practice. You have a 49-year-old non-smoking executive from Florida.
Yeah, well, so Neil, this was, you know, I'll tell you, this was a really tough case in that, you know, sometimes these HER2 mutants behave very aggressively. And I think I had in my mind when I started seeing these patients that it might be a little bit more of an indolent type with younger, healthier patients. But we often see, first of all, they often present with brain metastases, and they sometimes have really aggressive disease. And that was the case here with this gentleman. So he was a 49-year-old non-smoker. He was a good athlete. He was a runner, had run a lot of half marathons, was gearing up to run a full marathon. And, you know, he was just, you know, noticed he was feeling a little slower, a little more fatigued, thought he needed more sleep. And then he was just stepping off a curb and his femur fractured. And it turned out when they went in there to pin it, they found out that it was from metastatic tumor. So a guy who was perfectly healthy before this. And, you know, when they did the scans, they saw his skeleton really lit up, really tough disease in his femur. You know, I've seen this for some non-small cell where it almost looks like prostate cancer, where it really lives in the bones very often. So this was the type cancer, you know, that we saw. Turned out that he had this classic YVMA insertion. He also had a second alteration, this MYC amplification. And for those who've come across MYC in lymphomas, for example, other tumor types, you know, MYC is always a bad player. It just takes any bad tumor and makes it worse. So he initially started on trastuzumab deruxtecan. He had some improvement. There was a lot of enthusiasm. He had an improvement in his bony pain, got a lot better. His femur had gotten pinned and then it got radiated, you know, so it was sort of stabilized. But he did get beaten up, you know, after 6 months. You know, he started to have fatigue. His hair was thinning. We, you know, the regimen started getting spaced out. He eventually got two small brain metastases. And there was a lot of concern, of course, but we could easily treat these with Gamma Knife. So I didn't really think that was a true game changer because it was so easily treated. But boy, his disease came roaring back where he had widespread bony metastasis. That's where we put him on this zimgertinib protocol. But he really had a pretty modest benefit from zimgertinib compared to the other patients. You know, we had many, many patients that went out much longer than a year. He only ended up getting about 6 months. And again, we got shorter time duration when it was after trastuzumab deruxtecan than before. We ended up rating another CNS metastasis, but his disease came radiating, it came roaring back again. He blew through platinum in just a few months, and it just kept being more and more bony disease. We couldn't keep radiating it. He was the first gentleman in about a year, maybe more than a year, where we considered strontium, and I had to call my colleagues in the prostate cancer world that give these radiopharmaceuticals for bony mets. And he unfortunately ended up passing away about 18 months after diagnosis for a guy who was perfectly young and healthy before, you know, all this got started for him. So a tough case here of aggressive HER2 mutant disease.
You know, interesting that you got radium-223 because I always wondered whether or not it would work outside of prostate cancer. How did he do in terms of side effects on the zimgertinib?
Yeah, you know, when he started the zimgertinib, he really felt like this was a new life. And in fact, he actually said to me, you know, specifically, he says, "I feel like I'm normal again for the first time in however long since it was that he had started." So really did spectacularly well and initially had a really nice shrinkage. You know, I've seen this before, though, when you've got heavy bony disease, my sense is that you don't get the same drug penetration into bony mets. And this is seen in tumor types as well, where if somebody's got a heavy bony met burden, you know, you can radiate some of them. But that's this gentleman, just his disease just kept roaring back in the bones. So he had a great response. Initially, his zimgertinib felt better, tolerated it great, but we couldn't end up containing it in the bones, you know, after it came back about 6 months later.
All right, 55-year-old non-smoking woman.
Yeah. So she, just a lovely, lovely woman who would come and visit us in Houston, and, you know, always you know, we first hear about her plane flight because, you know, it wasn't a direct flight to Houston, even though you can fly to Houston direct from almost anywhere. She would have these long connections. So, you know, we would be seeing her every few weeks. You know, it would take her quite a while to drive to the airport, take connections and see us, but she'd make it. And, you know, she had another HER2 exon 20 insertion, this GSP. She came from the Beam and Lung 1, and she got started on zongertinib. So this was her first HER2 targeted therapy there. And she had a wonderful response at 120. Now, she was one of the early patients who had a little bit of a rise in her LFTs, bumped up, came down. Because it was early during the dose escalation, we ended up dose reducing it to 60. But she really wanted us to go back up to the 120 because she felt fine on the 120. But, you know, the rules of the protocol are you couldn't re-escalate the way this was written. So tolerated it well. And she has just been chugging along, doing great. And then after about a year, she had two tiny brain metastases. So, you know, the way the protocols go, that counts as progression. But this protocol allowed treatment post-progression. We radiated these two brain mets. And she just kept chugging along just great. She developed a little bony met that we also radiated. So she is now more than 3 years out. And we had, you know, sort of a good news, bad news event. It was all good news. I don't want to say there was bad news. But when the drug got FDA approved, she asked if she could just, you know, stop spending all her time traveling to Houston and just get the drug at home because it was FDA approved. And we said, absolutely. You know, so now we're just in touch as, you know, virtual visit, you know, social visits, basically. She's being managed by her local oncologist and is now over 3 years out, just taking now FDA approved zongertinib at the standard dose.
You know, you hear about these people with targetable mutations. Like, I kind of feel like I've heard more ALK stories like this, where they go 5 years. You see this with these HER2 mutations. How would you compare roughly the incidence of these prolonged responses compared to other driver mutation therapy-based therapies?
Yeah, I think your analogy is a very good one. I think we see this with EGFR. We see this ALK very often. I think with ALK, we even see more of them where we've got more people that go out, you know, three, 4, 5 years. And now if you look at lorlatinib, the median PFS is shocking. It's over 5 years now for lorlatinib. So we have lots of folks where they do develop progression. It's just one or two little, you know, mets, you know, what we call oligo progression. And we'd commonly just give them a little, you know, radiation, SBRT or gamma knife or just radiation to a bone and then keep treatment going. And that's the same thing we've done with zongertinib now, where people are tolerating it well. It's working well for the vast majority of the disease. And if you just get a single brain met or a bony met, we'd usually radiate those. Now, it's different if you suddenly get a whole bunch of liver mets, and that's a different story. There, I think if you get multiple liver mets, I consider that we've lost systemic control, when you get a lot of visceral mets. But for just a couple of bony or brain mets here or there, where you think the drug access may be the issue, I commonly just radiate them and keep going.
So I guess a natural question people have, we're about to hear about a case of a patient who got sevabertinib, but can you use TKI after TKI? And again, I'm going to go back to CLL, where clearly pirtobrutinib, you see responses to people who progressed on covalent TKIs. What about here? Do you see responses to the second TKI after the first?
Yeah, it's a great question. We just don't have enough data yet for this. We clearly see responses for TKI after an ADC, and we've got the opposite happening as well. We've got ADC responses after a TKI. We just don't have enough experience of TKI after TKI. Now, here I'm going to speculate what we're probably going to end up seeing. You know, because sevabertinib and zongertinib are distinct molecules, they're not similar to one another at all, I think there's going to be different ways tumors become resistant. And it's quite possible that some of those, you know, will respond well to one or the other. So, for example, when we first started seeing gefitinib and erlotinib resistance to EGFR, remember we saw T790M. And osimertinib worked beautifully for T790M.
Right.
On the other
hand,
for osimertinib, you can get C797, where it covalently links, And erlotinib and gefitinib can work for those.
Right.
So right. I think we're now in sort of the learning period of what type of resistance mechanisms emerge and, you know, how do we pick the right drug?
Really amazing story here. All right, let's hear about this 57-year-old patient, another non-smoker.
Yeah, and this was another one of the aggressive cases here as well. And I do get the sense that sometimes, you know, these HER2 mutants, you know, just get a switch turned on where they can behave very aggressively. You know, this one had the problem not of bony mets, but of liver mets. And this one started with bulky disease in the liver, and the liver was just the place where we just had trouble controlling it. So, you know, patient presented, a young, healthy woman who was very fit, exercised, ate well, you know, sort of did everything right that you can, you know, do for your health. And, you know, she just noticed she was more short of breath, and she was swimming and noticing she was losing a step on the swimming and didn't know why, then developed a cough, ended up being seen with the scan, and she just had diffuse lymphangitic spread in the lungs and then really bulky disease in her liver. And she also had this HER2 YVMA. Again, this is the most common HER2 mutation. It's about two-thirds of their two mutations. So she got started on standard chemotherapy with bevacizumab. Initially, nice shrinkage, but, you know, after four cycles or so, hit maintenance therapy and then progressed pretty shortly thereafter. This patient then went on sevabertinib and had a partial response. Liver mets got a lot smaller. The lung improved pretty dramatically. And this is something I've seen where it's easier to shrink lung tumors than it is liver tumors, you know, for whatever reason. Did okay, had grade 2 diarrhea. There was some management, had dry skin, had some mild rash, had the paronychia. So again, all the classic EGFR tox, but it was manageable. You know, had to hold the drug from time to time, but was able to hang in there. This patient then again developed progressive disease after about 7 months, and this was largely the liver mets. And then this patient went on to T-DXd afterwards, which she got locally and had a little bit of benefit, but it didn't last really long there as well. And then ended up going on multiple different therapies, went on some additional clinical studies and things that were off-label, but just didn't get a lot of benefit after that, and ended up making it about 2 years from the time of diagnosis. So here, you know, got all our best treatments, you know, but despite that, had pretty aggressive disease. And I think the bulky liver disease in the beginning sort of foretold, you know, that aggressiveness of her tumor.
So, I'm guessing you could present patients who have better responses than this. You see, yeah. Have you seen any really prolonged good responses?
Yeah, you know, I think the majority of cases, now I sort of showed two tough ones. The vast majority are more like the other case where people go more than a year, sometimes 2 years before their tumor starts to grow. And often when it does grow, it's just a spot here or there that we radiated. So I've got one gentleman from Michigan that comes and visited us, and he's now 3.5 years on the drug, taking a little higher dose. He was in the dose escalation of the study, just tolerating it great. Comes and visits. We talk about basketball. You know, we comes and you know, we run through our rankings for the NBA Eastern Conference and what do we think is going to happen. And then at the end, you know, I just say, yeah, everything else good? He's like, yep, everything else is good. You know, he's got essentially no side effects from the drug. You know, so just doing absolutely spectacularly. His life is back to normal on the treatment. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of these zongertinib-treated patients, where their life just goes back for as long as they're on the treatment, you know, to being, you know, just as close to normal as it can be. Similar to what we often see with EGFR inhibitors like osimertinib or ALK inhibitors, where people really just tolerate it well and do absolutely great with it.
So let's say you have a 88-year-old patient, pretty significant comorbidities, still, you know, interested in treatment, but really would not like to get chemo. You yep. really would not like to give this patient chemo who's got one of these YVMA mutations. If you could, would you give Zyngartnib first line?
Yeah, I'd give it in a heartbeat. In fact, I've got a woman who's a the mother of a faculty member who actually lives in a northeastern city that I'm sharing with another doc. And, you know, when we first sent her, he thought I was crazy, saying that she's 89. She's now 90. She was 89 when she started, but has just done beautifully, you know, and she probably weighs 90 pounds soaking wet, you know, with coins in her pocket, and is tolerating it with no problem whatsoever. You know, had a little PD and, you know, got a little spot of radiation, but, you know, has really done great with the drug. So.
And of course, I've got to say, then you've got another patient who's 65, doesn't have any of these comorbidities, but the patient's a medical oncologist and has seen one of your presentations and says, how about you give me Zyngartnib first line?
Yeah. Well, so the data in front of us right now, so the FDA label for Zyngartnib right now is second line, but we've just seen the data now. The data is just out. 77% response rate in the first line setting. Median PFS hasn't been reached yet, but it's clearly more than a year. So, you know, if you were somebody looking at chemotherapy, which we expect to be 4 to 5 months with a 30%-ish response rate, or a pill that gives you that, you know, pretty straightforward choice probably for most people. But right now, the FDA label is for second line.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me again of when ibrutinib was approved for BTK, and people are just starting to ask, what is it? And then when I would ask the investigators and say, well, what would you want to be treated with, even though it wasn't even approved then, they were like, oh, I'd want to get ibrutinib, because, again, yep. the alternative was chemotherapy.
Yep.
So, wow, this has been really fascinating. If I could, I just want to ask you about a couple other things that I see from your a very extensive CV, of course, with a million great papers, but a few things I had to ask you about. So one is a paper from the AACR last year. HER2 TKIs enhance the anti-tumor activity of HER2-targeted CAR-T, which I didn't even know exists, so you can maybe yeah. tell me about it. What are there is HER2 CAR-T, is there HER2 bispecific, so... What about, I don't know if you're familiar with zanidatamab. It's a yep. bispecific that hits HER2.
Yep.
What's going on in terms of other HER2-targeted treatments?
Yeah, well, I think you hit on some very important concepts. So we've been investigating, you know, now where do we go from the TKI, right? Now you've got a drug like Zyngartnib. Now, one possibility is you'd say, well, let's just combine it with chemo. But, you know, we've been looking at, can we find combinations that really could get us much further than that, right? You know, we see in the case of ALK now, with steady progress in the field, now that median PFS is over 5 years for lorlatinib. Now, one thing we're doing, we're going to be opening a study in the near future, assuming it gets approved, of zanidatamab, the drug you mentioned, which is a HER2 biparatopic antibody, so meaning it binds two different regions of HER2, that gives it some advantages over trastuzumab deruxtecan, in combination with Zyngartnib. So putting those two together.
Wow.
We've also tested, at least preclinically, Zyngartnib with trastuzumab deruxtecan. And in the paper you're citing, we tested it with the HER2 CAR. And the idea behind all of these is when you give Zyngartnib, you know, this tyrosine kinase inhibitor, it causes there to be more HER2 on the cell surface. And so essentially, drugs like the antibody drug conjugates or the bispecifics will hopefully work better in that case, because, you know, now you're sort of locking a lot of that HER2 up on that cell surface. And so at least in preclinical models and cell lines and in mouse studies, when we put together an antibody drug conjugate and a TKI, the two together work spectacularly, way better than either one alone. And when we put together a CAR-T against HER2 with Zyngartnib, it also works spectacularly. So I think that, you know, it tells us Zyngartnib may be a really good sort of foundation for us to combine these other types of HER2 therapies on top of.
What about CD3 type bispecifics like tarlatamab and, of course, all the CD3 bispecifics in myeloma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma? Are there CD3 bispecifics targeting HER2?
Yeah, so there have been some that have been reported recently. Now, the challenge with them is that, you know, there's always a concern about toxicity, like cardiac toxicity, because you have a small amount of HER2 expressed in the heart.
Right.
If you recall, for trastuzumab or trastuzumab deruxtecan, there's always a concern about cardiac toxicity. Now, over time, I think that's seen to be manageable and not a high percentage of patients. But it's at least a theoretical concern now as we start taking these T-cell engagers and bringing them in. So we are very interested in HER2 T-cell engagers with drugs like zongertinib. And, you know, I expect you'll see more data coming in the future about such combinations.
Same thing with EGFR, incidentally, osimertinib and these sort of immune strategies together.
Yeah, you know, that's right. So, again, the challenge with EGFR is a concern that when you make a T-cell engager, there's a lot of EGFR expressed in wild-type tissue, you know, gut, hair follicles, and so forth. So there's some concerns about toxicity there. Now, there's a couple of EGFR receptor T-cell engagers. There's one called REGN7075. This is from Regeneron. And instead of using CD3, it uses CD28 as the thing to engage the T-cells. So it's a way to try to get a T-cell engagement without turning up the heat the same way you do with the CD3 binder that might cause a lot of the toxicity. There are some other EGFR T-cell engagers out there as well. And I'm really enthusiastic about this approach, not saying which drug will end up being the best, but this general approach, because for patients with EGFR and HER2, it's often younger, healthier people where their immune systems are in good shape, but we don't have any therapy yet that mobilizes their immune system. So what a T-cell engager potentially could do is mobilize their immune system to attack these tumors. And I think that's really an important piece of how we're going to start really helping people live longer and longer.
All right. Well, let me just try to squeeze in a couple more questions about some of these really fascinating papers you're putting out there. And I see I got to ask you about this paper from this year's AACR. SARS-CoV-2 mRNA vaccines sensitize tumors to immune checkpoint blockade.
Yeah. Boy, this is an interesting analysis. First thing to say is this is all work led by a fellow here at MD Anderson. His name is Adam Grippin. And, you know, I'll tell you this, how this came about. You know, we've been developing for the last decade a big database of patients with EGFR, all these patients treated at MD Anderson, more than 18,000 patients that we have a database for. And this fellow came up in, right in the middle of, or towards the tail end of the COVID pandemic, just as things were starting to return to normal. And he was a guy who had trained in immunology, Adam Grippinad. And he said, you know, I'm interested in the immune effects of the COVID vaccine. And do you mind if we dig into the database? And we said, sure, you know, have at it. And he dug into the database and he compared how patients did with immunotherapy that had gotten the COVID vaccine in the last 100 days versus those who had never gotten the COVID vaccine. And, you know, I personally didn't think there'd be any difference because after all, the COVID vaccine is stimulating immune response against the M spike protein part of COVID. But boy, it turned out there was a huge difference. Patients who had gotten the COVID vaccine in 100 days before had a dramatically higher response. Now, the speculation is that this is because when you get a COVID vaccine, it not only generates an immune response against COVID, the M spike protein in COVID, but it's a general immune stimulant. It has something called the adjuvant part of it that stimulates your entire immune system. And that general immune stimulation, it's speculated, kicks up the effects of immunotherapy. So, you know, this raises the question, could we improve immunotherapy just by giving a COVID vaccine beforehand? And I should mention the publication for this, I believe, has just come out this month now in Nature. The publication is out. So,
I mean, not much downside to the COVID vaccine. You could say pretty good upside. Are you recommending it to your patients getting immune therapy?
Well, you know, we don't have prospective randomized data, but just as you said, the downside is small. And, you know, COVID vaccine, I think, is an appropriate thing for high-risk patients. And all of our lung cancer patients are considered high-risk patients. So I recommend it for everybody anyway for that reason. And, it, you know, if you get this extra bonus that it helps immunotherapy, great. You know, what a nice luxury to have something that you should be doing anyway that can potentially enhance the benefits, like exercise, you know.
Absolutely. So one final question, and I'm guessing this could lead to an hour discussion, but maybe you just give us a little tasting menu. I see a number of publications you have that begin with, for example, this one here from this year in Nature Communications, machine learning driven strategies for adopting immunotherapy, metastatic non-small cell. Another paper in NPI Precision Oncology this year, progress and challenges of artificial intelligence and lung cancer clinical translation. So we talk a lot about AI helping clinicians, you know, take care of patients and all. But what about AI in terms of trying to sort of sort through clinical research? And can you talk about kind of maybe an overview of where you see that heading?
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of different efforts in AI and how we could apply this for lung cancer to improve therapies. And here, let me just mention a few people. We've got a really large team, but Jia Wu is the leader of this on the AI side. And then we have investigators like Natalie Vokes and Jay Zhang, who are doing a lot of this work here. So I just want to make sure we acknowledge them. You know, so the idea here is that we've assembled these really large data sets. And you know, our ability to look for markers, we do have some ability just from our clinical practice to get a sense, right? When you talk to clinicians, they'll say, oh, yeah, you know, for people with bulkier disease or liver mets, I don't get as much benefit from immunotherapy. So that's a group I add chemo in. In fact, when you talk to oncologists, they will often have a lot of ideas just from their practice, if they treat enough patients, of which groups benefit more or less. But none of us can capture all the different nuances. So we've been using our big data sets to train our AI, what we call our foundation model, to say, okay, can we come up with better predictions? Who should get a CTLA-4 inhibitor with immunotherapy? Who should get chemo with immunotherapy? Who doesn't need anything else? Who might need radiation, what we call consolidative radiotherapy. And I think we're applying this also to patients with EGFR mutations. You know, I just presented at the recent ESMO meeting. We could use machine learning to predict who is going to have a response to neoadjuvant chemo and immunotherapy. And it predicted quite well with just the scans and training it the right way, you know, which patients, when you resected the tumors, we're destined to have a complete pathologic response. So we are really excited about these approaches. I think in the future, you know, we're not going to be leaving it to just what a physician is comfortable with or has the most experience with. We'd really like to be able to say for this particular patient, here's what your outcomes would be on choice A, B, or C, you know, and let physicians have, you know, all the data that we have in hand helping guide their decision-making.
We had a general medical oncologist who was presenting a case that we presented at a conference who brought up a really interesting idea. She'd had a patient who had a lot of cytopenias from a therapy. I don't remember what it was, but she brought up the question of could AI help in predicting toxicity, particularly looking at prior chemo, prior cytopenias, you know, stuff that, as you kind of were alluding to, you could have a general idea about, but more specifically predicting toxicities. Is that something that you all are looking at also?
Yeah, you know, it isn't the major focus, but we have one particular area, and here Jia Wu and Mehmet Altın in our group have put in a lot of effort, is predicting pneumonitis due to immunotherapy. So we've got a predictor based on how the lungs initially look about who's more likely to get immunotherapy-induced pneumonitis, which is a problem for lung cancer patients. And, you know, I think a lot of it is probably because if you've got a lot of inflammation to start with in your lungs, it's probably more likely that you're going to end up, that immunotherapy is going to tip you over the edge and you're going to get some, you know, real pneumonitis from that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Final question, and you know, I think a lot of people sort of think about this. You see AI helping and just finding new directions in cancer research, you know, not just trying to take the data we already have, but coming up with new ideas.
Yeah. You know, this is a tough one because, you know, the pluses and minuses of AI is it's got really what we call the black box approach, right? Where, you know, we'll work with our team and it'll predict something. And then you'll say, well, what was the predictor? Was it a mutation that the patient had? Was it the age? Was it their blood counts? And very often you can't figure it out. It's just that black box. So we're trying to pursue types of AI where we can then open up the black box and say, look, for this patient, it was because the tumor was big, or it was because the tumor was in the liver, or it was because they had a low white blood count. And then go back and investigate, you know, what AI sort of picked up on its own. Go back and investigate that in more detail. And that's an approach I really like better. Instead of just leaving it in the black box, because you don't know what's in there. It might be specific to a particular drug. It might be specific to a particular ethnicity of patients. But if you can have AI give you a signal, and then you can take that signal and look across different populations, that's really it's sort of a back and forth between investigators and AI is the approach I really favor.
Any thoughts about, you know, where we are right now? It just seems like even though there's so much more research going on, so much more translational stuff being done, but still really not that huge effect on cancer mortality. Do you see things changing in the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I do. You know, and you could think about there, I think there are some spaces that are going to slowly keep improving. So I'll give an example, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, right? I remember when crizotinib first came along and you saw a median PFS of 10 or 11 months, I thought, wow, this blows away chemo. Chemo is about 5 months, right? But then you've got a second generation of drugs and suddenly it was 20 months. And I thought, wow, you can't really do that. Now you've got lorlatinib, median PFS, you know, over 5 years, right? So that's a steady evolution. It's not that you're curing everybody, but boy, when you start getting out with that duration, you've got a lot of people getting a lot of benefit. So I think we'll continue to see better TKIs, and I think that'll be steady progress there. But I think we also can hit a limit. If you take EGFR, for example, you know, nobody's really improved on osimertinib except by using combinations. And that may be because at some level, the resistance is mainly not because of that one oncogene. You get sort of the EGFR independent resistance and you could block it perfectly, but at some point you start getting MET turned on or a small cell transformation or all these other ways you can become resistant. So I do think with TKIs, we're going to continue to see improvement, but there is going to eventually be a leveling off for the TKIs. The thing I think really could create a giant upside are T-cell engagers. And I think we're really just at the beginning of T-cell engagers because right now we use a pretty blunt approach. You know, most of our T-cell engagers are just what we call CD3 binders. Grabs a T-cell, grabs a target, sort of puts them together. But I think this is where I think we have a huge upside potential because as we get better at how to activate the T-cell, how to avoid exhaustion, how to connect it better with the tumor, how to avoid on-target toxicity, I think we're going to start seeing more and more tumor types where T-cell engagers have a giant upside, you know, for small cell. You know, after all those years of seeing barely incremental progress with small cell, tarlatamab has been a game changer for small cell. So I think the next 5 years, if you ask where are we going to see the biggest game changer, I'm going to put my money on T-cell engagers.
Subsequent to the recording of this program, the FDA granted accelerated approval to sevabertinib for adults with locally advanced or metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer whose tumors have HER2 tyrosine kinase domain activating mutations and have received a prior systemic therapy. This approval was granted on November 19, 2025, based on data from the SOHO-01 trial. This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. And throughout this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Hamock, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.